We are lucky to live in one of the most diverse places in the country, but without understanding the diverse cultures amongst us, misconceptions abound. So our goal tonight is really very simple. It's to create a better understanding of Islam among the general public. Let me begin by introducing tonight's panelists. At my far right, your left, is Sumbul Ali Karamali, who is the author of The Muslim Next Door, which, by the way, I can recommend, which I believe is going to be for sale after the program is over.
Yes.
Sumbul received her undergraduate degree from Stanford University, her law degree from UC Davis, and a graduate degree in Islamic law from the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies. She serves on the board of a nonprofit education institution that teaches multicultural education and is on the steering committee of Women in Islamic Spirituality and Equality. Seated next to Sumbul is Jihad Turk, and you heard that right, it is Jihad Turk. Jihad is the president of Bayan Claremont Islamic Graduate School. He received his undergraduate degree in history and Arabic from UC Berkeley, and his master's degree in Arabic and Islamic law from the University of Texas. He also co-founded the Muslim Christian Consultative Group and the Greater Los Angeles Muslim Jewish Forum. And finally, we have with us Maha El-Janaidi. Maha is the executive director and founder of the Islamic Networks Group. She received her undergraduate degree in political science and economics from the American University in Cairo, and her master's degree in religious studies from Stanford University. Maha has been recognized with numerous awards, including the Civil Rights Leadership Award from the California Association of Human Relations Organizations. So, Jihad, we have you sandwiched between the two Stanford alum. And we'll see how that works out at the end of the evening. All right? We want to begin at the beginning because the title of this evening's talk is Understanding Islam, What Does It Mean to Be Muslim? The Basics. So let me ask Maha to start in response to this question. What is Islam? Is it a culture, a cult, a religion, an ideological system, or a body of politics? I have heard all out there in the blogosphere.
That's right. So Islam is definitely a religion, and I would also add that it's also considered a way of life for practitioners of the faith, people that follow and practice the faith. And anyone who practices their faith would consider their religion also a way of life. Islam is a religion that is centered around the belief in the God of Abraham, the same God that is worshipped by other monotheistic traditions, Judaism and Christianity, and this is what we have in common with those two religions, and why you see very similar beliefs and practices, such as my hijab, for example, is something that you'll find also worn by Orthodox Jewish women and by nuns in the Catholic tradition. It's not a coincidence that you'll find these similar practices that are based on similar beliefs. Islam is essentially has three dimensions: faith, practice, and the third would be goals and objectives. So faith in God, the God of Abraham, faith in the unseen world, which includes the angelic world, faith in all of the messengers, beginning with Adam and Eve and ending with the Prophet Muhammad, faith in holy books or messages that were conveyed by God, and faith also in the hereafter or in the day of judgment and God's will. The second dimension, I want to just finish really quickly before you jump in, are practices that would include, begins with basic intentions, the belief in God and in the prophecy of Muhammad, prayers, giving back to the community in the form of charity or donations, fasting, and ending with pilgrimage. The third dimension of Islam, which I would consider to be the goals and objectives, and this is where I think you get the diversity. As an American Muslim, my goals and objectives would be to cultivate excellent moral character. Communally or out in society, it would be to abide by certain principles, social justice, gender equity, religious pluralism, all of the values that I think Americans would identify with. But keep in mind that Muslims are quite diverse. There are 1.7, 1.8 billion Muslims in the world that are spread out across 55 Muslim majority countries and substantial minorities, like the minority that, like American Muslims and Muslims in Europe. So you get a lot of diversity in terms of the way that they understand this third dimension of Islam in terms of objectives and how they fulfill these objectives.
Let me interrupt and ask our other two panelists, Sambul and Jihad. So how does that manifest itself in your daily lives? So you are all Muslim Americans. Maha has described the basic tenets of the faith. How does that make itself manifest in the way you go about living your daily life as compared or contrasted with other folks in the community? So, please.
Okay. So,
and let's be conversational, folks. This is meant to be a conversation that 400 friends just happen to be listening in on. Okay?
Yes. So first of all, I mean, yeah, sometimes people say Islam is a way of life, but what religion isn't meant to be a way of life? Right, all religions are meant to be ways of life, just as you know Christianity accepts Judaism within itself. Islam accepts Judaism and Christianity within itself. So, when I was growing up in Southern California, I don't think there was that much of a difference. To answer your question, Joe, it wasn't that different for me growing up. I mean, we didn't discuss religion on the playground, for example. So it only came up when if I went to someone's house and they had pepperoni pizza and I couldn't eat the pepperoni because it was pork, and then I had to explain why I couldn't eat the pork, that's when it came up. As I got older, the only other issue really was fasting during the month of Ramadan. You all might know that Muslims fast for 30 days. Okay, so I used to say we fast for 30 days, and people are like, oh, why aren't you dead? So it's actually, we fast every day from dawn to sunset for 30 days. You could eat at night. But sometimes, you know, I'd go to high school and, I was fasting one day, so no food or water till sunset, right? And I got to school only to find that that was the day we had to run the mile for the presidential physical fitness test. So whenever I talk to kids, I always ask them, what do you think I did? I could have either, do you think I sucked it up and just ran? Or do you think I went to my curmudgeon of a PE coach and told him that running was against my religion? So obviously I sucked it up.
I tried that and it didn't work for me.
It didn't work.
Palo Alto High School, class of 70.
Right.
It didn't work for me. Somehow.
It wouldn't have worked for me either. And so obviously, you know, those are sometimes, and as an adolescent, it's the differences that you remember, right? It's like, oh my God, you know, nobody else is fasting. I have to run the mile. But there weren't all that many. I mean, most Muslims grow up with the same things that other people of other faiths grow up, which is, you know, don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, be respectful to your parents. And then in the case of Muslims, you know, learn to pray. Our prayer is a recitation of many verses of the Quran. So learn to pray, learn to fast when you're a healthy adult. And otherwise it wasn't. Oh, and I didn't go to the prom, which was kind of traumatic for a while.
Well, speaking of the call to prayer, five times a day, Jihad, how does that fit in with the expectations of the wider community in terms of the commitment and obligation to answer the call to prayer five times a day?
Well, the good news is that the first prayer of the day is before you go to work or to school, so it's before the sun rises. It's a dawn prayer. The second prayer isn't until just after lunch. And the third prayer is just before sunset. So really, there's only one prayer in the day that conflicts with most work schedules. And the prayer only takes about 5 minutes. And you usually can find a quiet spot in your office or a classroom at school. Usually there's a teacher that will let you use their classroom when you're a youngster to make your prayer. They're actually quite supportive in most schools, and some of those high schools even have a Muslim Student Association, and they make accommodations for the students who want to fulfill that obligation. So it sounds ominous, like you have to go to prayer five times a day, but it's really just a quiet, meditative. It's a silent prayer during the day. And it does involve bowing and prostrating, and you need a sort of a small spot that's clean that you can put your forehead on. You don't want to put it on something that's smelly. I went to Berkeley, so I lived in the Bay Area for a while, and we went to, when I was a college student, went to a Giants game, and it came time for prayer. And so, baseball games are long. So, you know, you have a window of time in which you can do each of these prayers. Usually it's between an hour and 3 hours. So, but baseball games are long, and so it came time for prayer. So we went and we found what we thought was a quiet hallway of me and a group of friends. This is in the early 90s. And we were doing our prayer. And, you know, sometimes I think there's alcohol that's consumed at some of these games. And we were bowing and prostrating. And I remember this one intoxicated lady came, and she had a cigarette. And she's like, "Are you guys all right? Are you, 'cause you're bending over. Are you guys sick? What's going on?" You know. So we quickly finished our prayer and then just, you know, explained to her. And I'm not sure she quite got it. But I do have some friends, though, that were doing the same thing at another baseball game. And this was in the days after 9/11. And the SWAT team was called. So, you know, it can be a little bit awkward depending on where you choose to make your prayer. It used to be common to do it at airports. Not so much anymore. Some people are intimidated from making a prayer and then going on the plane, especially if they look very Muslimy. You know, with a big beard or with a headscarf. So, you know, it's... So I would say that's kind of the challenge sometimes, is just finding if you have a busy schedule or on the move to do the five daily prayers.
And you know, one of the conversations that takes place from time to time is about to what extent things that we all think of in the larger community as being functions of Islam are really cultural rather than religious. And Maha, you mentioned the 55 Muslim-majority countries around the world. Could you all just weigh in a little bit about the distinction between that which is cultural and that which is religious and the extent to which they overlap?
Yeah. So I actually, and I don't know if my colleagues would agree with me or not, but I actually think that culture and religion interact and you cannot divorce them from each other. I think one impacts the other. And so, for example, the food that I eat, I'm an American, so I will eat all sorts of different types of American food, Mexican, Italian, Middle Eastern, and so forth. But what I won't eat as a Muslim is pork, or I won't drink alcohol. The way that I dress, my dress is from the mall, from Nordstrom's or Macy's. But because I am a conservative Muslim, I happen to interpret things in a way that have me dressing quite modestly. I will buy clothing that that is modest, and so this is a perfect example of how culture interacts with religion. I don't have to go to the Middle East. I don't have to go to a Muslim-majority country to buy my clothes or to necessarily only eat food from Muslim-majority countries. I'm an American, so that's... Culturally, I'm an American, and I'm also Muslim, and the two interact with each other. And that's a simple example of how these two things...
You mentioned the hijab. Mm-hmm. You know, at the risk of stating the obvious, one of the two women on the panel is wearing a hijab. One is not. Sambul, what, if anything, should we infer from that, either about Islam or about culture vis-a-vis faith?
Yeah. So, religion is always interpreted through the lens of culture, right? So I have more in common, I think, with my non-Muslim American friends than with, say, a Muslim woman in Uganda, because our environment and our culture, I think, is... makes up more of our daily lives than religion does. Also, it's not just our religion and culture that is relevant here. It's also the culture that was present when these religious guidelines were developed. And this is true of all cultures, or all religions, right? So, you know, when Christianity was being developed, things were different. This was thousands of years ago. So culture has always been a part of how religion is interpreted. So so regarding the headscarf, I didn't grow up wearing a headscarf. Nobody I knew when I was growing up, no Muslim woman I knew wore a headscarf when I was growing up, not even in the mosque. So we would all go to the mosque, put on our headscarves in order to pray, and then take them off and stuff them in our purses afterwards. So and at that time, most Muslim women in the world didn't cover their hair. There was a rise of conservatism in all religions in the 1980s, and that's when you saw more Muslim women starting to cover their hair. I spend the longest chapter in my book is on women and Islam, and I spend a lot of time talking about why a woman might want to wear a headscarf. And in fact, I've had lots of people come up to me through the years and say, you know, I was prejudiced against women who wear headscarves until I read your book. So I felt like I was building those cross-cultural bridges. So I don't wear one myself, but it's in Islam, it's a choice whether you want to or not. So historically speaking, there were debates on what women should wear during prayer. Also, there were debates on what men should wear during prayer, by the way. You'd never hear about the men somehow. But it was all, you know, in these religious debates and opinions and discussions. And what they all agreed on, all these early Islamic scholars, what they all agreed on is that women should be covered from their shoulders to their knees. Beyond that, there was disagreement. Most of them said that only the hands, face, and feet should show. But then they also disagreed on, well, what is hand to the wrist or hand to the elbow? Is your chest should be covered, but is it the chest from the neck or the chest from the cleavage? Does feet mean feet to the ankles or feet to the knees? So there was a lot of disagreement about this. If you cover your hair, what part of your hair should be covered? So just recently there was a big public debate in Egypt between two very high-level Islamic scholars, and one said that it was a religious duty for a woman to cover her hair, and one said that it wasn't. So as a Muslim, you can choose who to follow. In the Jesuit tradition, there is a, I am told, sin of presumption, that if there are two scholars who are learned, then it's presumption for somebody to say one is right and one is wrong. So it's similar in Islam.
We do not have the sin of presumption in the political arena. I should tell you.
I should
just put that out there for the conversation. Maha, I'm curious to your reaction to that assessment and that, and frankly, I'm curious to your experience. Do you find people react simply to the fact that you wear the hijab?
Absolutely. When I give a lot of talks, and in the first few seconds of my talks, people are just, I think, stunned by the fact that I don't have an accent, that I that I sound intelligent. And they look at my bio and like, oh my God, you know, I actually identify with this woman, but why is she dressed like that? And so, yes, I do. And whenever I go shopping in stores, even in just grocery shopping, people generally ignore me until I open my mouth. I do feel it, absolutely. I feel the difference in behavior when I wasn't wearing hijab and when I wear hijab. I loved Sumbul's answer. I think it was a beautiful write-on answer to the issue of hijab. But I also want to add the idea of the principle of modesty. Modesty is really the principle that all people of faith are supposed to follow, and it can take different forms for sure. I just happen to follow a more conservative interpretation because it feels right for me, and I love wearing hijab. I really do. I just think that the way that people interact with me is, when they do get to know me, I think is wonderful. They're not focused on my physical appearance, but rather on my intellect, my character. So I've actually enjoyed wearing hijab for that reason.
And let me just ask one last question on this subject, which is, if I were to ask you, is your decision, your choice to wear the hijab, cultural, religious, both, neither, what would you say?
It's both. I think I'm one of those religious I don't want to call myself an academic because I don't think that I am, nor am I a scholar, but someone who studied religion quite a bit, not only at Stanford, which is secular, but also I studied with scholars from Zaytuna College for 15, 20 years. And I cannot divorce culture from religion. I think both of them impact one another. But I do think that the principle of modesty is absolutely there in all of the religions.
Jihad, I think...
I don't have anything to say on this topic.
Well, modesty. I think the principle of modesty is an important one for both men and women. It doesn't just apply to women. And the idea behind it is not just dress. It's also interaction with the opposite gender, which has to be free of sexuality for the preservation of the family, working towards developing a society that is moral and that preserves the family. So it's not just about dress. And I think that's really important to explain.
Jihad, I actually had a different question for you, Jihad, and that is, you know, from time to time we will hear the debate or a suggestion that Islam is inherently inconsistent with Judeo-Christian traditions or Western values, or that there is inherent in Islam some notion of a war on modernity. What are your thoughts about this? I mean, you know, we're talking with three panelists here who are Californians, and if there's a place in the country where modernity has arrived, I would think it's got to be California. So is there a conflict? Are there conflicts with part of your faith, or how would you characterize it?
Yeah, well, thank you for the question. As was indicated in Meha's answer to the question, what is Islam? She rightly pointed out that there is a common ancestor in Abraham. I like to think of it in these terms. My mom, who's Christian American, my father, who's from the Holy Land, he immigrated here in the 50s to Merced, California, as a 17-year-old and finished high school there before meeting my mom, getting married, and moving out to Arizona, where I was born and raised. But So when I began my spiritual journey as a teenager, I looked at both my Christian heritage and my Muslim heritage. And what I discovered was that as close as Judaism and Christianity are, Judeo-Christian society, right, Islam is right in between. We are closer to Judaism than Christianity is, in that we are more strictly monotheistic, and plus the focus on law, dietary law, and, you know, we have the kosher. They have kosher, we have Sharia, which we can talk about, I think, in another panel. we have Islamic law. But closer to Christianity in that, and this might be surprising to some, Muslims recognize Jesus as Christ the Messiah, born to the Virgin Mary, inspired by the Holy Spirit. So Jesus is our example and the way that we try to emulate to approach God. So And there's a greater focus on the Day of Judgment, heaven and hell, the values that will put us in good standing on that day are shared amongst all three. So we're closer to Christianity in those fundamental ways, and closer to Judaism than Christianity is in those other ways that I mentioned. And so we are right in the middle of a Judeo-Christian value system. With regards to modernity, as a historian, I did history at Berkeley. So looking at it from the historical perspective, modernity, if we want to talk about modernity as being, you know, part of a Western liberal democracy and the industrial age and all of those kinds of things, these first developed in Europe, right? And so the rest of the world, as Europe was forming nation states, were being kind of compelled out of this these empires and divided up. Sykes-Picot after World War II divided up these empires into nation states, and they were kind of dragged into modernity and into governance structures that really symbolized modern times in a way that wasn't as organic, I would say, as what happened in Europe. And as a result of that, in the Middle East, you have all kinds of challenges with governance, and we see that taking place now, resulting now in all kinds of conflict. However, I just came back from Indonesia, which is the third largest democracy in the world, and they are a pluralistic society, and I co-chair, as part of the U.S. Indo Council's U.S. Indo Society's Council on Religion and Pluralism, and President Obama and their president, and I love his name, Joko Widodo. So we had Obama and Widodo summit back in 2016. 2015, and so they said, well, let's encourage the second and third largest democracies in the world, because we're only number two here in the United States. Number one, of course, is India. All right, we have an educated audience here. Let's figure out how we can do this religion and pluralism.
These are my constituents.
That's right.
Of course they are.
Careful.
So we said, let's look at this very large, hundreds of millions of Muslims live in Indonesia. Let's look at how they are well-adjusted, for the most part, in their being a pluralistic democracy. And let's try and use that model and export that model to the rest of the Muslim world that is still struggling with some of these things. Oil, I think, is a factor as well, which is a whole nother subject. But, so I would say the short answer is, I don't see anything incompatible with Islam and modernity other than the historic artifacts that, lay the foundations of many of the cultures and the lands where Muslims happen to reside.
Sambul?
Yes, I wanted to say two things. One, Carl Ernst at the University of North Carolina points out that 15 to 20% of all religious groups are fundamentalist, if you describe fundamentalism as a rigid black and white ideology. So what was very interesting to me about this is not the number, not that it's 15 to 20%, but that it's the same throughout all religions. And that means that we're not really talking about religion, right? We're talking about humanity. 15 to 20% of human beings are drawn to black and white rigid ideologies. So I think when we're talking about modernity, that's something to keep in mind. The second thing is that religions don't modernize on their own. There has to be an outside external impetus. So Judaism and Christianity were able to modernize in response to the Industrial Revolution. But at that time, Muslim lands were largely under Western colonization, and they were not able to modernize. Muslim educational organizations, institutions like the equivalent of seminaries, were either dismantled or they fizzled out for lack of funding, and so there was nobody left to modernize. So most of these countries have only gotten their independence in the mid-20th century, and so now they're starting to be movement now. Now we're building our institutions and organizations.
Before I ask the next question, I just want to remind members of the audience, you too can ask a question. Simply fill out the question card that you have. Raise your hand, and someone will walk down the aisle and pick that question card up. So please make sure we have your questions here in the next few minutes if you can. There's been repeated reference to Islam in the context of other nations and other cultures. So would Islam be would your faith be different? In another nation, another cultural environment? I mean, we've got American Muslims, we've got Arab Muslims, we've got South Asian Muslims, we've got Asian Muslims. What does that locale, if anything, do to the faith and to the core values of Islam?
Let me start with that answer. There was a 12th century Muslim scholar named Al-Ghazali who talked about Islam and its cultural diversity with the following metaphor. He said, Islam is like a stream that has clear, pure water. And that stream travels over various lands. And wherever it travels, it allows the color and the texture of that land to shine through. So the water is the same wherever it goes, but it looks very different wherever it is. And so half of Africa is Muslim. When you go to Africa and you're in a Muslim country, whether it's the Gambia or Senegal or somewhere like Egypt or Morocco, it looks very African, looks very Moroccan or Egyptian. And when you go to Indonesia or Malaysia or tens of millions of Muslims in China, where they have a pagoda-style architecture for their mosques. In Mali, they have these mud structures. And in Bukhara and in Iran and Persia, they have these incredible structures that are particular to their culture. So I would say that Islam, even though the core values are the same, the cultural context of the religion is definitely reflective of the environment to which Islam spread. Now, Islam spread to these lands, it didn't bring the culture with it. The people had those cultures wherever Islam spread to, and they just adapted some of the practices of the faith and adopted some of the values. But I have to say, a lot of the places to where Islam spread, let's say they were tribal, they might have been chauvinistic in their treatment of women, Islam did not succeed in transforming the culture sufficiently to make those cultures no longer misogynistic or no longer mistreat women. So you find places, and I can pick on both the Arab world as well as Indo-Pakistani culture, you know, Afghanistan and Jordan and other places, Iraq, where there's a tribal attitude that is an honor-shame society, and some of those cultures mistreat women. I would say Islam doesn't mistreat women, but some Muslims do, and we can't ignore that.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Those cultures had those attitudes towards women before Islam got there, and I wouldn't say that it's an expression of Islam, but it's in spite of the values, the true values of Islam, is at least I understand.
Well, I'm going to interject at this point because we have a couple of questions from the audience, and while we do have a third session, which is entirely devoted to women in Islam, on this point, Jihad, and other panelists, two questions. In Istanbul, I saw men wash their feet before prayer. Do women also do this, I suppose, in separate places? And the other comment or question is, the perception, underlined, is that the push for modest dress is driven by male control of women in the Islam culture, question mark. Mm-hmm. So why don't we pick it up from Jihad's comments and move to Sumbul and then Maha for comment on those issues anyway. On a topic that it will be revisited in more depth at session number 3.
Right. So could you repeat the first question?
Sure.
Washing the feet.
Oh, washing the feet. Yeah.
It's a washing your feet question, and whether
that's
or
right.
not
that's right.
women so, also wash their feet.
Yes, women then, also wash their feet.
Very clean feet.
Yeah.
And
there's a ritual of washing before you pray. So before you pray, you have to make sure you're clean. And there's an order in which you wash yourself before you pray, and that's for men and women.
And tell people why.
Well, because you're going to be in the presence of God. And so you don't want to be dirty and smelly in the presence of God. You want to be respectful. And so that's why we wash and make sure we're clean beforehand.
And then the next comment / question is, the perception is that the push for modest dress is driven by male control of women in the Islam culture.
Yeah. So that's also something that has to do with context. So when the early Islamic scholars were talking about dress, they, as I said, they did talk about dress for men as well and what was modest dress for men as well. And very often, you know, recently I saw a picture of, the Kuwaiti Stock Exchange. And all of the men were just as much covered as any women would be. You know, only their face, hands, and feet were showing. So,
and they were wearing dresses too, right?
And they were wearing dresses. They were all wearing white dresses, in fact, or robes, actually. So, you know, some of it has to do with culture. You know, very, very few, the vast majority of Islamic scholars actually say that a face veil is required. By far the majority say that a face veil is not required in Islam and that it predates Islam from a time when everyone wore something over their faces in order to keep the sand out because it originated in the desert. So those are ways in which culture affects what people wear. You know, my dad, I didn't know anyone who wore a headscarf, but I asked my dad about it once when I was growing up, and he said, it used to be that, you know, if you didn't wear a headscarf, that was incredibly immodest, and you wouldn't be protected. You know, you would be vulnerable because of it. You would be conspicuous, and that's not the case for you here. So we don't think you have to wear a headscarf. So all these things change in terms of context.
Yeah,
I don't think they have to do with. Go ahead.
Yeah, so all the practices and all the beliefs and everything that is required on men is also required of women. There isn't different practices for men and women. Everything applies to both equally. I think that's that needs to sort of a point that needs to be made. And as far as
But just to clarify then, the headscarf
is The headscarf
the particularities.
Is,
modesty is for both.
Right.
But
exactly.
And the question often comes up, about location in the mosque during the time of prayer.
Right. Right. I just wanted to respond to the question that I thought was a very good question. The requirement or the presumed requirement of wearing the headscarf is a challenge for many women, and I think it does cause me concern, quite frankly, because the focus then becomes on the form of dress instead of the principle of modesty. And modesty is a very personal thing, right? A woman can be modest, and women are, without necessarily having to cover their hair or dress the way that you see me, dress by covering everything. And so when you require a certain form of dress on women, it is problematic. And I wish that, more people would focus on the principle of modesty and leave it up to women to choose how that takes place for them instead of requiring the headscarf and the dress that you see me wearing. And I do have concerns about Muslims requiring a particular form of dress in order to be modest.
Let me just tie in before you get to the second part of that, just to be conversational here.
Yeah.
That one of the things that I appreciate most about my my culture here as an American Muslim is the idea that, having freedom of religion and free speech and the freedoms that we enjoy here, it makes religion more meaningful when it comes from yourself as opposed to being imposed, whether by men or by societal norms. And, I appreciate when someone goes outside of their comfort zone and goes against, let's say, normative practice. And I'm in awe of someone who chooses to stand out a little bit because of their conviction. And so, I think that that's one of the benefits of living in the society. And I can say without hesitation, it's impacted my very understanding of theology to say that I think good religion, true religion, should not be imposed, whether by men or by women. The practice of religion shouldn't be imposed by the state or by society. It should be, most truly an expression of one's commitment and devotion to God and not an obedience to your fellow human being.
Thank you. And then as far as the location of where Muslim women stand in prayer, which is usually viewed as being behind men or in some cases, of course, women are standing side by side with a barrier in between. And the reason for that is because of the physical nature of the Muslim prayer. I think either Jihad or Sumbul mentioned the fact that we bow and we kneel, put our forehead on the ground during the prayer. And so it's considered to be immodest for a woman to be standing in front of a man doing that. And so in the prayer hall of a mosque, there is a barrier between men and women. And also praying in congregation, you do have to touch the person that is next to you. But that's only in the prayer hall of a mosque. Outside of the prayer hall, men and women engage with each other, and there's no sort of separate spaces in the rest of the community center or the mosque.
All right.
Can I just say though, I'm a little impatient with. I mean, that's true, but I'm just a little impatient with that because I just feel like, okay, those men should be looking at the ground and not at other women's rear ends anyway. So.
I promised you conversational. You got conversational. There you go.
Well, I want to say before you
get really want to follow that up. Yeah. Okay.
Not on this topic. Right. Not on this topic. I was going to say this is. You have a very polite audience here, and maybe they're thinking it, but they're too shy to say something in the questions at least that you've gotten to so far. My name is Jihad.
I was going to get there.
You did kind of highlight that at the beginning, but you know, I don't want people to walk away listening to this radio show that said what Palo Alto welcomes jihad without challenging him, right? So. So I just wanted to explain how I got my name, right?
Let's go there, and let's use that as the opportunity to talk more broadly about what jihad means and what it doesn't mean, if that's something you could share as well.
Very good. So, you know, as I said, I'm an American kid from Arizona, and growing up in the 70s, I was born in 71, in Phoenix, there wasn't a lot of diversity at that time. You were either black, white, or Mexican. That was pretty much it. And so I was out in the sun. I was a little bit darker. People thought I was Mexican with an exotic Mexican name, maybe Oaxacan or something. Yeehaw. And so, you know, it wasn't an issue growing up. This was way before 9/11 or anything else. And so, you know, it really wasn't a problem, other than that it was a little bit awkward for people to remember and to say. And so I remember playing soccer when the roster came out. I was 7 or 8, and it was passed out to the parents. And my name, my teammates called me Jay for short, and they wrote J-A-Y, Turk. And my father, who named the boys in our family, we were 5 kids growing up, I had 3 sisters and a brother. My dad named the brothers, the 2 sons, and my mom named my sisters. And so my father looked disappointed, and he crossed out J-A-Y, and he wrote J-I-H-A-D, and he made dittos, for those who remember what dittos are. And he only half the crowd laughed. And he passed them out at one of the games on the sideline, and I was like, Dad, what are you doing? He's embarrassing me. He said, no. Your name, I chose it, has a great meaning. It means the struggle to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And it might be hard for people to say or remember, but it's worth that extra effort. And so I've always gone by jihad ever since then. And so it wasn't until 9/11 that I became a walking teaching moment. So, but the good thing is, again, because I don't look too intimidating, even though I have an intimidating sounding name, you know, most people feel comfortable in approaching me and simply asking me the question. I don't face discrimination. I don't face harassment. You know, maybe sometimes on the phone, it's like, your name is what? But, you know, most people who encounter me, they feel comfortable enough to just ask me the question, and they're genuinely curious as to the answer. And so, you know, as I grew in my scholarship in Islam, I, you know, studied the term in greater depth. And there is, I would say, 3 levels of it. The first one is the one that my father taught me growing up, and something I tried to live up to. And the second one is social justice. It's the struggle and strive in society for equality, for justice for all people. And then, yes, there is this notion that you can take up arms in defense of your country, but it is not terrorism. And terrorism is something that's antithetical to the values and teachings of Islam. And if anyone tries to claim jihad in the commission of an act of terrorism, they are doing something that's an affront to the foundational teachings of the Quran and of the Prophet Muhammad. In fact, there's a verse in the Quran that says, to take a single innocent life, it's equivalent to killing all of humanity, and it's an abomination in God's eyes. So,
Sambul?
So the way I think of jihad, and by the way, my 4th grade teacher called me Shamu for 2 weeks.
Shamu?
Yeah, if that makes you feel any better. So... So the way I think of jihad is there's an internal jihad and an external jihad. So the internal jihad is the struggle to make yourself a better person, struggle to do the right thing. The external jihad is the struggle to make society better. So you can do that in one of 3 ways. You can have jihad by the hand, which is when you do good works to make society better. So volunteering at a soup kitchen is jihad by the hand. There's jihad by the word, where you can use your words to make society better, like writing to your Congress people, and please write to your Congress people. And then there's jihad.
I think there's a confirmation hearing coming up. Just saying.
And then there's jihad by the sword, which is taking up arms in self-defense or to overthrow an oppressor. That's it. And even if you do have a legitimate military jihad, there are very, very strict rules of engagement. So even if you have a legitimate jihad in self-defense or to overthrow an oppressor, you may not kill civilians, you may not commit terrorism defined as the clandestine use of force, you cannot kill people in holy buildings, non-combatants you cannot kill, children or the elderly you can't kill. I mean, very, very strict. You can't poison the water supply, you can't uproot trees. So when you hear jihadist as synonymous with terrorist, that's like calling the KKK defenders of Christianity. So it's a very different thing. Terrorism has always been prohibited by Islam from the very beginning, and there were severe penalties for it.
Maha, any comment on
also,
this?
Can I just say one more thing?
Oh, please, go ahead.
Okay,
Sobel.
And then while some Islamic scholars were developing this doctrine of military jihad, others were developing a doctrine of the jihad of patient forbearance. And this is a nonviolent resistance jihad that, of course, you've all heard of this, right? but what it is, it's based on Prophet Muhammad's first 12 years in Mecca, where he was persecuted. He and his followers were tortured, but they didn't fight back. They practiced nonviolent resistance by continuing to preach their religion and to emigrate. And then also it's based on the many verses in the Quran that urge patient forbearance. There are many more of those than the ones that urge fighting. So there are many examples in modern times of the jihad of patient forbearance, which I won't get into because I know we're running out of time. But something to know about.
Maha? Uh-huh.
I don't think I have anything to add other than just to say that holy war, which is often used in association with the word jihad, actually in Arabic means or is harb al-muqaddasa. It's not jihad. Jihad is defined exactly as Jihad Turk defined it, which is a struggle, a striving. And the most important, the most powerful jihad the way that Muslims generally interact with the word is striving to exemplify the best of character, excellence in everything that you do. That's the way that we generally interact with that word. The fact that it's been made to mean something completely different and something vile and horrible is just devastating. And as Sumbul pointed out, using that word in any way or shape or form in association with a terrorist is only strengthening that person and you know making his or her struggle to be a lot much more than what it is, which is criminal. It's criminal, is what it is.
I want to say one thing after she's finished.
The term jihadist in association with terrorism is such a mistake. And even using terms as our president today likes to use. Radical Islamic extremism, which doesn't really mean anything other than it implicates anyone related to the religion of Islam. Who is he referring to? Call it out by what it is. Call it ISIS. Call it Al-Qaeda. Call it Hamas. Call it whatever it is. When you use terms like radical Islamic extremists or whatever the terms that he uses, and he thinks that that is the right approach. It isn't, because it's implicating people like me, ordinary Americans who happen to be Muslim, and the vast majority of Muslims who understand Islam the way that we do and practice the way that we do. And it's not really identifying the culprits. It's doing exactly the opposite of that, and that's a major problem.
To be continued at session number 2. We have lots and lots of cards with questions about Sunni, Shia, Sufi. Could somebody help us understand the different branches of Islam, if that's the proper term? I think the term sects is not looked upon favorably, if I understand it correctly. So,
well, we have sects in Islam.
Do we? All right. That's good.
But yeah,
thank goodness they can edit the tape. Jihad. That's it.
I'll begin by just saying that Muslim, there are 1/4 of the world's population is Muslim. 85% identify as Sunni. Other 15% or so identify as Shiite. And I would say that they overlap theologically in 99.9% of the doctrine. The difference between Sunni and Shia is less theologically than between Catholics and Episcopals. or between even Methodists and Lutherans. So it's a very, you know, subtle differentiation between these two, and primarily it's rooted in authority and a political difference that occurred early on in Islam that created this political split that then got theologized, right? And there was a little bit of theology that crept in there as to who has authority.
And this is the Sunni version.
This is the Sunni version.
No, it's important to point out for the Shia sitting in the audience.
So, but I did study both at the Islamic University of Medina, but also in Iran and in Qom. There are historically, there has been periods of time in which there has been tension between these groups, and long periods of history in which there was complete integration. There are a lot of marriages that take place between Sunnis and Shias. Their kids, of course, are both Sunni and Shia. They're Sushi. No, that's they're not Sushi. But
you
know,
couldn't
sometimes
resist,
their kids,
could you, Jihad?
Sometimes
you
their
just
kids,
couldn't resist.
Sometimes they just identify as Muslim, and you know they don't necessarily have a strong affiliation or identification as one or the other. And it's very interesting when someone embraces Islam, they said, "Okay, I'm Muslim. Now I have to choose between being Sunni or Shia," and so it does become a bit of a journey, if you will.
But a number of the questions go to the perception that there is not just conflict, but violent conflict between Sunni and Shia.
Yes, but I would argue that just as in Northern Ireland, when you had the Catholics and the Protestants fighting over authority and power in that state, it wasn't so much about doctrine. They weren't talking about the Catholic Church versus, you know, the Protestant Reformation. They were one, you know, what do we call that? Identity politics. One group who identified their culture, their tradition, their group, their in-group were the Catholics, and the other ones were the Protestants. There was a history of the, you know, the role that England played as a Protestant colonizing force in the region. And, you know, they were striving for the power of the state. And so they would resort to terrorism and other things. Not that that's part of the Catholic doctrine, but it has to do with geopolitics, the history, you know, militarization, you know, so many different things, democracy. And so when do we see Shia-Sunni conflicts arise? When you have tension, oftentimes in democracies, over who's going to have power of the state. And in the case of Iraq, really what you have is a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. One is they're two superpowers of the region, both oil countries, heavily subsidized by their oil revenues, trying to get influence over the region. Iraq is right in between. 60% of the population is Shiite, so they politically are more aligned with Iran. Saudi Arabia feels threatened by that because their oil is located in a part of their country where the 15% minority of their population is Shiite. They don't want the Iranian revolution to come to their territory and take the oil revenue with them. So it has to do with geopolitics. It has to do with economics. It has to do with identity politics, oftentimes democracy or revolution. And religious identity is just kind of one of the factors that is a rallying cry for the us versus them. Has nothing really to do with the theology.
Maha?
I would absolutely agree with Jihad. And if you study the Shia and Sunni conflicts in different parts of the Muslim-majority countries, you'll find different reasons for that conflict. In Pakistan, it's different than what's happening in Yemen or the Emirates, and I think that that's something that we need to look at. It's not based on theology. I think it's a way to identify politically, based on tribe or a political identity, but it's not due to religion that the conflicts exist. And a testament to that is the fact that Sunnis and Shias in this country get along incredibly well. And since these conflicts arose in different parts of the Muslim world, they've made a deliberate, intentional effort to come together, to pray in each other's mosques, to do work together, to sort of demonstrate to both, you know, their constituents, their congregants, to the United States, and to Sunnis and Shias around the world that there is no conflict based on theology or religion. But the conflicts that are there are rooted in geopolitics, as Jihad pointed out. I think he did a really good job in describing.
Sambul, I see you leaning in.
She was going to let me just say one final thought that I was going to say before, but I think this one just ties it all together. Thank you very much, Sumble. If you can imagine what you would think is the most peaceful religion in the world, Buddhism, is being co-opted by ultra-nationalist extremists in Myanmar or Burma to rally people from the temple, the pulpit, right, the Buddhist monks, to go out and commit atrocities against the 2% minority Rohingyan Muslim community, then any religion can be used as a galvanizing force to inspire people to go out and commit an act of violence. It has nothing to do with Buddhism, and I'm not blaming Buddhism as a religion for those atrocities that are being committed in the name of Buddhism. And I think something similar happened in Christianity in the past, if I understand my history right. So, I mean, it's now Islam's turn, unfortunately, and we're trying to struggle to reclaim the values of Islam and the perception of the religion from those extreme minorities, 0.003% of the population that would support groups like ISIS.
I want to go to Sumble because we have so many good questions, Maha, okay. that I need to get to the other questions.
I want to put it in just in a little bit of a different context because... I think, first of all, we all should understand that it's really easy when you see two groups or more fighting and you don't really know very much about them, it's really easy to say, oh, they've been fighting for centuries. They've been at each other's throats for centuries. We can't do anything about that. They're always going to be fighting. And I think that's really a cop-out. And I hear it every time there's some sort of fighting that goes on elsewhere, abroad. So that is something that has happened with the Sunni Shia reporting as well. I'm not saying that there's never been tension. Whenever you have a minority-majority group, you're going to have tensions sometimes. But historically speaking, there's never been anything as large-scale in terms of Sunni Shia conflict as there was, say, between Protestants and Catholics, or there's nothing like the Spanish Inquisition, like nothing on that scale. So what has happened with the reporting of Iraq is that, and I actually spoke to an NPR reporter who said, yes, this is true. Very often, it might be a resource war, but it gets reported as sectarian violence. It might be, wars over infrastructure. It might be wars, general criminal thuggery. It might be struggles for power. But it's just easier to report it as sectarian warfare. So in Iraq, Sunni Shia marriages were so common as to be unremarkable. After the invasion, as the country has broken up into sections, it's been much harder for those couples to stay in the country. So my husband's great-grandfather was Ismaili, which is a small, a very, very small percentage of the Shia. So he was Ismaili, and he had three sons, and one stayed Ismaili, and one became Sunni, and one became Shia. So we have all of those in our family, and there's really no difference. I mean, I agree. There's no theological difference, meaning no difference in the way we look at God or the Prophet, in either of those.
Maha, I've got other questions. We're running out of time, and I apologize. One of the things we promised people was that we would ask the questions that normal people wanted to ask. So here are four questions from normal people. Regarding clothing, what are your thoughts about a government, say France, making it illegal to wear a headscarf? Should that be permitted or not? Why would a woman take her headscarf off when she enters, the airplane coming to the United States? Is the burqa an extreme individual choice of clothing? And for all three of you, what bathing suit do you wear? That's what the question is.
Burkini.
I'm gonna let you all figure out how you briskly answer questions about clothing. We've covered a little of this. Start with some bull and just come down the row briefly, please.
Boy, okay. Swimsuit, I actually have developed a photosensitivity, so I wear a coolie bar swimsuit, which is more covered, just because I need to be more sun protective. But growing up, I wore a swimsuit. Like, I had to swim during PE at school, and I wore a swimsuit. And is that covered from the shoulders to the knees? No, it isn't. But, again, it's context. Everybody's wearing one. It's for a purpose. That was okay with me and my family. That's my personal thing. Burqas, again, in terms of how Islamic law is is concerned, face veils are not considered by most Islamic scholars to be required for a woman. In fact, CNN called me when the producer called me and said, we want to know, you know, the burqa ban went into France today, and we want to know what you think of it. And I said, well, I don't think it's Islamic. I don't really like it. But I think if a woman feels like it's her religious duty to wear it, then she should be allowed to. And they said, okay, thanks. We wanted someone in favor of the burqa ban.
Jihad, so, yeah. Your thoughts on this subject?
Board shorts.
All right. We thank you for your brevity. That was not a pun, Jihad, okay? Maha.
I don't have that issue of what to wear to go swimming because I don't swim.
All right.
I ran track. I played lacrosse, played softball throughout high school. And I was running all the way up until maybe a couple of years ago. So and I would just run in sweats, and I would tie my scarf in the back the way that Orthodox Jewish women do.
Although Nike just came out with a new sports hijab.
That's right.
Good to know.
I'm fine with just tying my scarf behind my back. Burqa, do I think it's extremist? I don't. I don't, because I think, as Sumbul pointed out, it's a woman's choice, and if this is how she feels modesty is for her, then I totally accept it. The same way that I, you know, I don't mind women dressing in any way that they want if that's what they choose to do. So I don't consider that to be extremist. I forgot the rest of the questions, but
it's
do you
all right.
Go on?
We've got another question, and I think it's a good one, which is, what Islamic leaders do you pay attention to, and who should we pay attention to? And then the rest of the question clarifies. It says, what I mean here is that we know who the Catholic leadership is. Mm-hmm. It's structured, and we know who mm-hmm. speaks for Catholics. Mm-hmm. Ditto for Protestant denominations. But what about Islam? What Islamic leaders do you pay attention to, and who should we pay attention to?
Oh, that's a great question.
Sumbul.
Well, that's a great question. I think the structure of Islam and Islamic law is more, which, by the way, Islamic law is a misnomer. It's not law the way we think of law, which is statutory and enforceable. It's more like religious guidelines. But the structure is more like Judaism. So, you know, we have the Quran, which is our holy book. We have the words and deeds of the Prophet, which is called the Sunnah. And then we have the body of religious interpretation of those religious texts, which is called fiqh. And all of it is Islam. So the fiqh is very much like the halakha in the Jewish tradition. It's religious interpretations of the texts. That's right. We don't have a hierarchy. We don't have a pope. And so it's a good question, because I ask myself that question too. As a Muslim, what I do is I look at who is a learned Islamic scholar. You know, what are their credentials? Who is learned? And then I listen to them, and do I want to follow this particular scholar? Do I want to follow that scholar? I mentioned that there was a big public debate between Islamic scholars in Egypt about whether a headscarf was required. So they were both learned. You know, one was the Grand Mufti of Al-Azhar University. The other one was a very well-regarded Sharia scholar, head of the Supreme Court in Egypt. And they had a debate. So I can say, okay, well, I'm going to follow that one because that's who I want to follow. They're both learned. I can follow either one. So that's...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I would just add that, you know, Islam is the most disorganized religion out there.
Right.
We don't have any hierarchy. We don't have a pope, which is a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing in the sense that, you know, there's not a corruptible, and I like this particular pope, so I'm not suggesting anything about the Pope Francis. Go Francis. But you know, there's no institution that is corruptible, you know, by a particular, you know, point in history and individuals. But it's also a challenge because there's no one to speak for us, because the number one question we're always asked is, mm-hmm. how come you guys have never condemned terrorism? When I kind of hinted at it, you guys all clapped. Like, that was the first time we heard a Muslim, you know, condemn terrorism. Because there's no one who speaks for us with that, from that bully pulpit, who can make it known, like, this is the official position and we can excommunicate those folks over there. We don't have anyone who can do that. But But it just so happens that the overwhelming majority of Muslims kind of coalesce around these very basic principles that we started out with, and which is the subject of tonight's talk, the belief in one God and trying to be good people. Mm-hmm. And those who are extreme look extreme in compared to everyone else. The problem is when you're not amongst Muslims generally and you only see them or us on the news, it's in an extreme example, and so there's you know, confusion results.
Maha?
The names that I would look for are people associated with Zaytuna College. So Hamza Yusuf Hansen, who's the co-founder of Zaytuna College, Imam Zaid Shaker, who's associated with that as well, and many of the teachers that are associated. And you're very fortunate because Zaytuna College is actually here in the Bay Area. They're in Berkeley, and they're on Holy Hill, I believe it's called, where all the other divinity schools are. So I would actually Google him, Hamza Yusuf Hansen and Zaytuna College, because those are the sort of my teachers and the people that I look to. These are all American-born, American-raised that have studied in seminaries abroad, have come here, and are, you know, talking and speaking about Islam in the context of American society. And then I would also name a number of women scholars that I follow. Dr. Amina Wadood, who's written extensively on women in Islam, Dr. Aziz Al-Hibri, when I got married, I actually had a contract. It's similar to what some Jewish couples do, and I looked up her work, and I actually used the contract that she suggested for women, which has been incredible, actually. Firyal Salem at Hartford Seminary, and a number of other female scholars. Ingrid Mattson as well, who's in Canada now. Asafa Qureshi, who's in Wisconsin, and several other Muslim women scholars that are operating here in the United States. We could name a lot, and I think we need to bring this back up
when we talk about women. Go ahead.
I just want to make a difference. There is a difference between people who are academics and who are clerics, right? So some of those people that Maha mentioned are academics and some are clerics. So Asafa Qureshi, for example, is not a cleric. So that's something to keep in mind.
I'm going to ask one last question because we are just about out of time. And I'm going to ask that we go to Maha, Sumbul, and Jihad. Mm-hmm. What's the biggest misconception about Islam and the Muslim community that you confront, either in your work or in your day-to-day lives? The biggest misconception that you confront. Maha?
That Islam is monolithic, and that's why I started out by talking about diversity. The fact that there are 1.7 billion Muslims in the world, they live in 55 Muslim-majority countries. There are also sizable minorities in America, in China, and throughout the world, in Russia, and throughout Europe. And they are not all subscribing to the same monolithic culture or same ideas about a lot of things. They all, you know, subscribe to foundational beliefs and practices, but other than that, they have different opinions about a number of issues. And I think that that's the number one thing that I'd love for Americans to know, is that Muslims are as diverse as Christians. You've got the Catholics, the Protestants, the Orthodox, and within the Protestant tradition, just in the United States, you have over 10,000 denominations, right, which is based on their readings of Scripture. And so you have that kind of diversity also among Muslims.
Sumbul, mm-hmm. Biggest misconception?
I would say that Muslims are different from everybody else in the world. And
that's,
you know,
the misconception or the reality?
That's the misconception. Okay, all right. You know,
I was confused there for a second.
That's why we have three panelists, by the way. So.
You know, Muslims are treated as exceptional. You know, and this, you know, I was going to say that it's that Muslims are violent, but that's really part of the bigger picture, that Muslims are different somehow. And we have the same, you know, we all have nutcases in our religions. And, you know, we all have people who do good things and bad things, and there's always a variety. But yet, negative things that Muslims do anywhere in the world are always seen in our public discourse as confirmation that Muslims are different and not like other people.
Jihad?
I'm going to just say one thing, which is, I think, at the core of the Islamic faith, which is our belief in God. Oftentimes, the word for God in Arabic is used, Allah, and sometimes people think that Allah is a different entity. whereas Allah is the way that Jewish Arabic-speaking individuals refer to God, and Christian Arabic-speaking individuals refer to God when speaking in Arabic. It's like saying in Spanish "Dios" or in French "Dieu." So we believe in this in the same God, God the Creator, God the Father. I mean, God the Creator of our forefather Abraham, and our ultimate goal is, you know, we have the same value system as Christianity and Judaism, and our ultimate goal is to try and live our lives such that when we stand before God on the day of judgment, not that we can earn His grace, but that we might be more worthy of His compassion and mercy.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight... tonight was an effort by my office and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley to try and provide a little bit more in the way of understanding Islam. As I mentioned earlier, we have two additional sessions. I hope that you will join us for those if your schedule permits. I hope that you have enjoyed this evening's program. And again, we want to thank Sumbul Ali Karamali, Maha El-Janaidi, and Jihad Turk, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio and the web. And now, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you all very much.